And I'm joined in the studio right now by Dr. Ann Lopez. She is currently a visiting professor and postdoc researcher in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley. She has also taught courses in biology, environmental science, ecology, and botany in the biology department at San Jose City College for many years. Her research addresses the human side of the binational migration circuit from the subsistence and small producer farms of West Central Mexico to employment in California's corporate agribusiness. Dr. Lopez has worked with 33 farm worker families in the Salinas and Pajaro Valleys. She has also studied 22 of their family farms in the West Central Mexico countryside and has received recognition and awards for her work. Her book entitled The Farm Worker's Journey summarizes the results, arguments, and conclusions of her research and is scheduled to be published by UC Press early next year. Dr. Lopez's findings while interviewing Central California farm worker families and their family members in Mexico were fundamentally disturbing and life-transforming. As a result, she is actively attempting to create awareness about the human rights abuses that are endemic to every juncture of the migrant circuit. She has also initiated many projects on both sides of the border designed to alleviate some of the inordinate suffering experienced daily by migrant farm workers and their family members in Mexico. To this end, she is in the process of establishing a nonprofit organization on behalf of Central California farm workers and their family members living on subsistence farms in Mexico. She is also developing a website with information about the current status of the family members in her study and ways in which those that are interested can become involved with the work of improving their life circumstances. One of Dr. Ann Lopez's main arguments around immigration is that the large influx of undocumented immigrants from Mexico is the direct result of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, a trade, quote, agreement strongly promoted by the United States. And I'm very pleased to be joined in the studio this afternoon by Dr. Ann Lopez to talk about this very important issue. Hello, Ann.
Hi.
Hi. So why don't we begin by talking about some of the history of farming practices in Mexico. What have the farming practices in Mexico been historically?
Well, Mexico has some of the most sophisticated systems of farming historically. They were able to, Mexican farmers many years ago were able to support cities of 100,000 people, and they did this without any of the current industrial technology that's used in farming. And because of their sophistication in these farming practices, they were able to support these huge cities, which in turn supported these wonderful civilizations, Mesoamerican civilizations. And in the area of the world where I studied, or the area of Mexico where I studied in West Central Mexico, one of the crops systems that has been used for centuries and probably thousands of years is the corn, bean, and squash intercrop. And that system is so effective that the farmers who plant it actually get 50% more corn yield than if they grew their corn in a monoculture or just as a single crop. And a lot of scientific studies have been done on this particular intercrop system, which includes corn, bean, and squash. And there are many intricate mutualisms that protect this particular intercrop from insect invasions, promote large crop yields, and also actually replenish the soil so that after the crop is harvested, the soil's in better condition and more fertile than before.
Are folks in Mexico still farming this way?
Well, some of them attempt to do that, but their market forces and the forces, market forces of free trade in particular, so-called free trade, and the neoliberal economic model have really put pressure on subsistence farmers. So it's making it almost impossible for them to farm in this traditional way in Mexico any longer. And many of them have left their farms, as I mentioned before. There's an estimated 1.75 to 2 million who've had to abandon their farms since NAFTA went into effect in 1994.
Now, you're saying that one of the factors contributing to the demise of this type of sustainable farming in Mexico is NAFTA, is so-called free trade agreements like NAFTA. Can you be a little more specific, get into exactly, okay, first of all, maybe we could talk about what was promised with NAFTA and then what the reality was.
Right. Well, the many of the people that supported NAFTA, including the banks and industries and corporations, promised that that NAFTA would provide an upgraded diet for everyone in Mexico. It would reduce immigration to the United States, illegal immigration, by equalizing the wage differential between Mexico and the United States. It was lauded as the first green trade agreement, and Salinas de Gortari in Mexico spent $30 million promoting it. And so people looked forward to NAFTA as a chance to stay at home in Mexico and have an upgraded life, and that's not what has happened.
What has happened?
Well, what's happened, in fact, is that in the first 5 years of NAFTA, 4 million people, more people, went into severe poverty. 51% of the rural countryside now is living in severe poverty. 158,000 children, ages infancy to age five, have died every year and continue to die every year since NAFTA went into effect. And in the area that I go to, in the countryside, people are literally starving to death. So they're coming here as economic refugees. They don't want to be here. That was very clear in the interviews that I did. Most of them do not want to be here, and the only ones that want to be here have been here for many years and have most or all of their family members here with them.
So what led to the deaths and the poverty that you describe? What were the factors? What exactly happened with NAFTA that led to this scenario?
Well, the neoliberal economic model subordinates all social and developmental considerations to the free market or capitalist economy. And what that means is that when countries join in a trade agreement, a so-called free trade agreement, what happens is that oftentimes they have to borrow money, especially if they're third world, in order to restructure their economic system so it will fit with their trading partners. And this is exactly what happened to Mexico. So the World Bank lent Mexico what's called a sectoral adjustment loan. That gave Mexico the money to restructure its economy and become part of NAFTA, or the North American Free Trade Agreement, with Canada and the United States. And one of the loan conditions was that it drop all subsidies and all social programs and instead, pay back the loan. Well, all of the corn sector, the subsistence farmer corn sector of Mexico has long been supported by the government. So the government was actually supporting farmers by buying their corn at above international prices. And so without any warning, essentially when NAFTA went into effect, all of those price supports and subsidies were canceled. So nearly overnight, people's return on their corn crop was halved. It fell by half. And so what that means is that they have half as much money as they used to have, and many of them couldn't even break even. I mean, they actually lost money. It costs more just to grow the crop than the return will reimburse them for. So they basically are there with no money, sort of stranded. And what happened was the NAFTA originators assumed that they were not part of the market economy. But every single household that I talked to said that they sell between a quarter and half of their crop in order to get money to pay a physician or to buy shoes or to buy clothing or whatever the family's needs are. So
Sorry. When you say that they, the crafters of NAFTA, thought that these people, that the farmers you're talking about, were not part of the market economy, you mean they thought they were just growing enough of their own, like they were just living off the land, like they didn't need any other services? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically that.
Like they were just eating corn.
Well, actually, Victor Toledo in Morelia, Michoacan, is a professor, and he calls these subsistence farmers multi-use strategists, because what they do is their primary source of nourishment is the corn, bean, and squash intercrop. But in addition, they are very adept at going out into the countryside and harvesting various kinds of edible plants, roots, etc., even harvesting fibers for making clothing and so on. And once in a while, maybe going to a village or going into town and earning some extra money doing some work on a farm or whatever for a big landowner. But so in a sense, almost they are able to cover almost all of their needs. But there are some that aren't. For instance, if you need a physician, you really can't. You really have to pay the physician, and you're not going to find the items needed to do that out in the countryside someplace.
So. I'm sorry now that I interrupted you.
No problem.
You were going somewhere with that. You were talking about how the people who created NAFTA didn't think of these farmers as part of the market economy, but they do need these services, and that, you know, everyone you had met had at some time needed shoes or a doctor or whatever. And I'm sorry, you were kind of going somewhere with that, and I jumped in with a question.
Well, part of maybe I can sort of take off on that point, but when the individuals that crafted NAFTA decided that, again, the subsistence farmers were not part of the market economy, so it wouldn't affect them. Mm. And at the same time, they said that growing the corn, the way the subsistence farmers were doing it, was inefficient. So part of the thinking was that if you undercut the price of their corn by shipping in and dumping U.S. corn into the countryside, then they'll leave and go to, quote, better jobs in factories and so on. So the idea was that to have the U.S. produce all the corn for Mexico and use these people on the farms as a labor source. Of course, no one ever consulted with the subsistence farmers themselves to find out if that was a viable alternative in their mind.
So it did end up affecting them quite drastically.
Drastically.
Talk about, again, some of the things that happened. Were many farmers forced off the land into maquiladoras or into, you know, really low-paid jobs in factories? Like, talk about some of the things that went on.
Well, I met some farmers who decided to stay and starve. I mean, what people have to understand is these subsistence farmers are very attached to their land, and it's very moving to have them show you their farmland, because they know every single rock, where every single shadow is cast, what you plant where and when in order to get the best yield. So they have this intimate relationship with their land and the natural world, and to leave their land is really a form of torture. And beyond that, to leave their families, I mean, the families, these farm families are very, very tight, and this land is passed on from one generation to the next. And the family and the land are everything, and people love that lifestyle. They just live in sync with basically the cycles and the seasons of nature. And so what happens is, you know, they sit down with a family and decide they're all going to starve unless somebody does something. So the first step is, do we want to starve here or do we want to move on? And typically the male member of the family, but more often females in this recently, leaves the farm and goes to a large city like Mexico City. And Mexico City now has at least 21 million people. And it's so huge that when I was in a plane over Mexico City, you literally could not look out a window and see the edges of the city. It's just huge. So there's these shanty towns appearing around the edges where people are hoping to find work, and of course there isn't any. And when that option is exhausted, then they head to the United States. And everybody know, and that's the least favorable choice. People think they're coming up here because they want to use our services or whatever, and it's not. This is survival, people. I mean, these are economic refugees that are really victims of this free trade globalization program that's going all over the globe and disenfranchising people all over the planet, particularly the poor. The poor are really the ones that are having the roughest time.
In the description of your book, which hasn't come out yet, but again is called The Farm Worker's Journey,
mm-hmm.
And when will it be coming out?
Well, I'm hoping the end of this year.
The book concludes, it says here in the description, with the construction of a binational framework of institutional constraints that maintains the flow of potential farm workers from Mexico to California and from which escape is nearly impossible. Can you explain that? Escape is nearly impossible from this. Can you talk about that?
Well, yes. Actually, if you study the institutions that impact subsistence farmers' lives in Mexico, and also look at the institutions and laws that impact farmers and farm workers, rather, in the United States, you see that there is a framework of laws and institutions that this binational population is caught up in and from which escape is nearly impossible. And some of those include, for instance, the impact of the Catholic Church. This is an institution that, except for people, some priests who have broken out of it in Mexico, this is an institution that's invested in maintaining the status quo, which is that your life is hard here, but you'll be rewarded in heaven type of thing. And then from there, there's the Mexican military. And any time, the Mexican elite is terrified that these subsistence farmers are going to organize again and start another revolution, which basically the uprising in Chiapas was in response to NAFTA, because that happened on the very first day that NAFTA was initiated. So that the Mexican military is very prevalent in the countryside, you see, and the farmers there, the subsistence farmers, are kind of afraid of them. They tried to stay out of their way because, like they said, they can expropriate your land, they can take you away and put you in a jail cell forever, and so there. You know, I heard many, many stories about that. And then, of course, migrating up here, then you've got to deal with border patrol issues. And once you become hired in agribusiness, then you're dealing with a whole set of laws that in which there is no overtime pay, there's no limited work day, there's not even requirements that you have a certain number of restrooms per however many workers. And so all along this circuit, then, there are violations of human rights. And I think for people and I can go into some of those if you'd like later on, but I think for people who are concerned about human rights and are not comfortable knowing that 14 miles away from Santa Cruz, people's human rights are being violated, I think that this is something that we all have to take to heart. The reason why I think they're so little known is because, of course, this is a voiceless population, and also there's a cultural divide here where farm workers, by and large, have had very limited education. They're monolingual Spanish speakers, and oftentimes in the migrant camps are separated far from the towns in which the mainstream population lives, so people hardly even know they're there.
So again, we're talking about a situation where historically there have been sustainable farming practices in Mexico, and as you talked about, the corn, bean, and squash intercropping that was very effective at feeding people, and then now you have the contrast of very little diversity in the crops and GMO corn and, mm-hmm. and things. And you're saying that, you know, the demise of this sustainable farming culture is partly due to NAFTA, but there's other factors too. There's the so-called green revolution technology. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that affected things?
Yes. There's actually four factors that are making the corn, bean, and squash intercrop sustainable farming practices nearly impossible in the West Central Mexico countryside today. And the first is green revolution technology. This was a technology that was supposed to feed the world, and it was based on high-yielding varieties of cereal crops, including corn. And these crops began being introduced into the larger agricultural cities like La Barca and also Zamora in the 1940s. The problem is that the yields are dependent on heavy use of external inputs such as fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, and so on. So initially, this new farming technology was practically given to these subsistence farmers, and then over time, as they adopted it and could no longer go back to their sustainable farming practices because their land had been so altered, the prices of these chemicals and seeds and so on increased tremendously. So now, you know, most subsistence farmers can either purchase the seeds or the agrochemicals, but not all of it because they have such limited income. And then in recent years, with the development of genetically modified corn, 30 to 60%, or about 20,000 tons of genetically modified corn now is being sent to Mexico from the United States, and this stuff is going out into the countryside and contaminating all of these strains of corn that were hand-selected for thousands of years to fit the microclimate of each individual plot of land for each farmer and his family. So we're losing all of this genetic diversity, and we're basically homogenizing corn throughout the world, and Mexico is a classic example of that. Plus, we don't know, there haven't been tests on what the impact of these genetically modified strains are on either humans or the environment, and some of the preliminary studies are not encouraging. There's a lot of people have allergic reactions to GMO corn and so on. So the Green Revolution and GMO corn infiltrating the countryside is certainly one of the issues. And then another issue that's impacting the West Central Mexico farming culture is the overturning of Article 27 of the Mexican Constitution, which was the article of agrarian reform that established the ejido system or communal farming system, where groups of villagers farmed communally and collectively and made decisions in a democratic way and had meetings once a month and so on. So that was overturned in 1992 in preparation for NAFTA, and now all of the land is privatized. So each farmer can sell or rent his or her land or whatever they want to do with it. And then the North American Free Trade Agreement followed that on January 1st, 1994, and since then, of course, we've had a lot of corporate activity in the countryside, and what I see happening is we're basically sending all the products that are not selling well here, usually because of their health damaging effects. So you see a lot of agrochemicals on the shelves in West Central Mexico that have been banned in the United States even since the 70s, or have been restricted and so on. And so, you know, these subsistence farmers purchase these chemicals, and many of them are deadly, and they have no idea how toxic they are. They can't even read the containers in many cases. So you have this problem where many farmers are dying because they're poisoned by these chemicals, and or they're disabled. And then the agrochemical companies are not the ones that have to pay for their disability. Instead, the relatives who are up here working legally or illegally, are sending back remittances which go to their care. So it's a really very difficult cycle.
Another aspect is corporate penetration, is transnational corporations in Mexico, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's another factor. Can
right.
you talk about that as well?
Well, there are, for instance, these agrochemical giants such as Monsanto and Cargill and Syngenta and so on. There are these giant corporations that are either sending their agrochemicals to Mexico. For instance, in this country, a chemical can be restricted and not available for use in this country, but that doesn't stop a corporation from manufacturing it and sending it to a third world country. So that's one aspect of it. And then the other thing is that some of these companies have actually partnered with Mexican franchises to produce the chemicals there. So the chemicals is one aspect. Another is, for instance, Coca-Cola. In Mexico, Mexico has the largest per capita consumption of Coca-Cola products anywhere in the world. And there is a high incidence of diabetes within the Latino population. And judging from the symptoms of people that I talk to in the countryside, there's a lot of diabetes around that goes undiagnosed simply because people don't have the money to go to a doctor and get treated. Well, when you infuse the countryside with Coca-Cola, with all of the aggressive advertising that goes with it, people start drinking this, which further compromises their health because they may be both malnourished or starving and diabetic. And then what you get is, people dying from or potentially dying from health effects caused by these transnational corporations. I'll never forget going to Zamora one Christmas and watching a Coca-Cola Christmas, where they had a huge tree with Coca-Cola bottle caps and playing songs, Christmas songs with Coca-Cola dubbed into the lyrics, and Disney-type bears bouncing around in the plaza hugging kids with Coca-Cola, and then giving people free samples. And people take the free samples and start drinking it, and they actually become hooked on it to the point where they're willing to sell the healthy things that they grow on their farms, like the eggs from chickens or corn or whatever it is they grow. They'll sell that to get the money to go buy Coke. And the same thing is happening with Pepsi-Cola, another transnational corporation, and Marlboro cigarettes. So these destructive things are really the American legacy in the West Central Mexico countryside. It's like one of the municipal presidents told me. He says, the United States sends us all the bad stuff. I mean, that was his view of the U.S. and what we are offering these impoverished people.
Now, what about some of the arguments that are made often in the letters to the editor and just generally in talk shows and such about immigrants, such as, well, they're coming here to live off of our social services, to take advantage of welfare, and to have kids here, so their kids, if they're born here, will be a U.S. citizen and can, take advantage of the American dream. And they're essentially invading the United States to live off our social services and leech off our wealth and our... So what do you make of that argument, which is a very common one?
Well, it is, but there are many fallacies with many parts of that argument. Number one, not everybody wants their children born in the United States. I've had a couple of family members, women who are pregnant, who actually returned to Mexico to make sure that their children were born in Mexico and Mexican citizens. So that's one part of it. The other part is that people don't understand that these people come from a culture in which the work ethic is very, very strong. I mean, part of being a human being is hard work. And if you talk to any foreman who hires immigrants, undocumented or otherwise, he or she will tell you that these people are hardworking, and that's why they like to keep them as a crew working for them. So work is what they come here for. They come here to work and survive. They don't come here to use welfare. I mean, most of the ones I talk to don't even know welfare exists in the countryside. They don't even know what it is. All they know is that there's jobs in the United States, they're starving in Mexico, and if they can make it past the obstacles on the way to the United States and get work, they might be able to survive and support their family in the process. Now, regarding using welfare and all of this, I mentioned this, I'll never forget, I mentioned this to one farm worker from who lived in a village near Sinapecuaro, and he was furious when he heard that. He says, Americans think that, but we don't use welfare. We don't even respect people who do. And he said that he has worked as a farm laborer in the United States for 40 years, and his brother has worked about 30 years, and the only time they ever used any kind of medical treatment or whatever was when his brother broke his leg and the family literally did not have the funds to do anything about it. But, you know, so people go to hospitals and to emergency rooms and so on really as a last resort, and especially if they're undocumented, because they're afraid. Undocumented people are like shadows in the culture. They hide because they're afraid of being deported. And especially, typically in families, what you find is a legal resident father, an undocumented mother, and maybe one or two undocumented children, and maybe one American citizen child born in this country. Well, the mothers live in constant fear of deportation, because if they're deported, what's going to happen to their kids and their family? And this is a constant concern to many of them. Now, in terms of figures and statistics, it's very important to recognize, and I listen to these congressional discussions about how, you know, we have to design legislation so that if farm workers are normalized, then or illegals are normalized, they have to pay back taxes. Well, they're already paying taxes. They pay 1/7 of the gross domestic product of this state of California. That's approximately $500 million in taxes that they can never retrieve. They can't do itemized deductions and get some of that back if they're undocumented. And on a national scale, undocumented heads of households provide $6.3 billion in taxes, and that supports all of Social Security. So, you know, I don't know where these arguments come
which
from.
Which they can't collect.
They cannot collect either.
Social Security, so they never get back.
Yeah, if they're undocumented. And that's just the undocumented ones. Never mind the ones that are legal residents or the ones that are documented or American citizens or whatever. And that's a whole nother tax base.
Now, what about the argument that the Mexican government is so corrupt and this is the reason why the country is so impoverished and why people are poor there and want to come here? It's all the Mexican government's fault.
Well, you know, there is some truth to the amount of corruption, although certainly in recent years we've seen our share in this country as well. What I see is that the huge influx, I mean, there's always been immigration from Mexico to the United States, but at a much slower rate. But this huge influx in recent years is a direct result of NAFTA, and the NAFTA originators knew this would happen when they constructed the North American Free Trade Agreement. And 1 year after NAFTA went into effect in 1995, the Mexican government claimed that at least 1 million people had left their land. So this is new. I mean, this is within the this is since 1994. This isn't about a history of corruption in the government. I mean, that's part of it. But the main thing, the U.S. has a key responsibility because it supports these trade policies all over the world, and they're devastating to poor people. And I think we have to at some time come to terms with our responsibility as American citizens for generating this kind of immigration and pain and inordinate suffering that these people are in.
I'm speaking with Dr. Ann Lopez. She's joining me in the studio. She's currently a visiting professor and postdoc researcher in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley. And we're talking about immigration and NAFTA. She has worked with 33 farm worker families in Salinas and Pajaro Valleys, and she also studied 22 of their family farms in the West Central Mexico countryside. Her findings while interviewing these family members were fundamentally disturbing and life-transforming, and as a result, she is actively attempting to create awareness about the human rights abuses that are endemic to every juncture of the migrant circuit. And again, as you've heard, one of her main arguments is that the large influx of undocumented immigrants from Mexico during the 1990s is a direct result of NAFTA. And I'm going to take calls in just one moment. I'm going to give out the phone number, but I wanted to read before I do a short clip from an article titled "Who is Responsible for Undocumented Immigration to the U.S. and What Can We Do About It?" from Anne. Here's a quick quote. "The United States is the largest corn producer in the world. Within 30 months of NAFTA's initiation on January 1, 1994, cheap U.S. government subsidized corn was flowing into Mexico tariff-free, undercutting the price of the corn grown by Mexico's subsistence farmers. Mexico's subsistence farmers have been impacted so negatively that they are faced with only two negative choices: stay in Mexico and starve to death with your family, or risk a deadly undocumented trek through the desert to the U.S. as economic refugees. The human rights violations inherent in this predicament and indirectly promoted by the U.S. and its support of NAFTA have resulted in inordinate suffering and pain as family members are strewn between Mexico and the U.S., as Mexican farmland deteriorates, and as women and children are left in Mexico to fend alone." That from an article, "Who is Responsible for Undocumented Immigration to the U.S. and What Can We Do About It?" That was published in Peace Action.
Yes, the Peace Action
California
newsletter.
Peace Action. Before I take calls, and I already have somebody on the line, I wanted to get to the solution part, the part, what can we do about it? And I want to know what your proposal is. And then we'll open up the phones and jot down the number now, folks, 427-3772, 831-427-3772, to call in and speak with Dr. Ann Lopez.
So regarding solutions, is that the...
Yeah.
Okay, the next thing. Well, there's a number of solutions. One, I think, is to tell the truth. I literally never hear the truth being told about NAFTA, either from congressional representatives in Congress or just in conversation. I have found two articles in a newspaper that even mention NAFTA as connected with undocumented immigration to the United States. All of the discussion is an after-the-fact treatment of what to do with 12 million now-termed illegal aliens. And there's absolutely no acknowledgement or recognition of this country's role in forcing them to come here in the first place. I mean, to me, this is just one of the cruelest things. Number two is that border legislation is country-specific. In other words, Mexico has its laws regarding the border, and the U.S. has its laws. Well, it's a binational boundary, and it needs to be negotiated and monitored as such. It's not just a line, half the line of which is owned by the U.S. and half by Mexico. And country-specific border legislation, along with no recognition of a common labor market, is not working, and that's NAFTA has no recognition of a common labor market, and it's creating violence at the border and continues to perpetuate the lies. We need to revise NAFTA from a free trade agreement to a fair trade agreement that specifically includes Mexican low-wage laborers and also subsistence farmers, along with those who are impoverished and the elderly at the table. And the revision must include human rights for all and an adjustment that promises improved life circumstances for all the disenfranchised groups, not just for the wealthy and huge corporations as it stands now. And also, Mexico needs to develop legislation, farm legislation, that includes small subsistence farmers. Then number four would be to divert a small percentage of the inordinate amount of taxpayer dollars that's being used to unsuccessfully guard the southern border for proactive rural development programs that have a tried and true history and can work in rural areas of the three states from which most Mexican immigrants originate, and these would include Michoacán, Jalisco, and Oaxaca. And there are tried and true rural development programs doing fabulous work all over the planet. These include the Heifer Project International, the Jane Goodall Foundation in Tanzania and other African countries, and the Muhammad Yunus Grameen Bank in India. And personnel from these organizations can train Americans who are overly concerned about undocumented immigration on the process involved with the development of these local rural economies. And then, once those are established, the subsistence farmers will have the option of staying in Mexico. And my research suggests that that's what they want to do. And then, finally, I think we should address the inherent racism of the U.S. border policy by diverting attention away from Mexican immigration. 57% of illegal immigrants to the U.S. are Mexicans, and yet 80% of the deportations are Mexicans and are of Mexican people. And we've never had a so-called terrorist come across the border. And, you know, shouldn't we redirect our attention to other things that are more critical, such as the indebtedness of future generations of Americans in the Iraq War issue, or the fact that 45 million Americans don't have health insurance, and some of these other issues, rather than scapegoating people who are hungry, tired, sick, and dying, who are trying to get to find a life where they can survive for themselves and their family. So these are general things, and then maybe later on after the questions I can talk about things each individual can do.
So your main one of the main parts of your plan or idea for a solution would be to divert some of the money that would go into building this, the billions of dollars that would go into building this border wall, into development projects in several of the states in Mexico where most of the immigrants come from, so that, you know, they actually have a life there, and most of them are going to choose to stay put, right?
Right, and this is a proactive way of dealing with it, rather than this punitive, dramatic legislation that's coming out of Congress. And all this drama about the National Guard going down and guarding the border and the Minutemen and all of this huge drama, when, you know, there's really it's really an example of overkill, and there will always be people coming across the border undocumented. I mean, that's just a fact. In my studies in Mexico, there were planes leaving Mexico full of undocumented immigrants. So the highest wall in the world is not going to stop that. It's going to continue. What you have to do is offer people an incentive so that they can support themselves and their families, and most of them will stay home.
Going after the root. And I agree with you that, you know, in my experience, I've worked on a lot of farms, and I've worked with a lot of immigrants. I don't know their status, and I don't really want to, one way or the other, if they're, quote, documented or whatever. But I know that everyone I met would have preferred to stay in Mexico with their family members. And I even have known guys who left their wife and kids behind and haven't seen them in years, and talk fondly about their home and can't go back, because if they did and tried to get back here and live, they'd be risking their life. Anyway, I want to open the phone lines now.
Can I just say one other thing, too?
Yes.
It must be really a wonderful thing for people who use undocumented labor to be able to hire people at such a low rate and have no responsibility about it, and have the focus shifted and the blame shifted onto people that have no voice.
Yeah.
And I think that needs to be addressed, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'm going to open the phone lines now, and I want to let people know the phone number again, 831-427-3772, and I do have a caller who's been waiting patiently on the phone. Hello, caller? Hello? Did you hang up? Well, I don't know what's going on with this phone. I'm going to have to invite that person to call back. 831-427-3772. And hello, caller.
Hi.
Hi, you have a question for Dr. Ann Lopez or a comment?
Yes, I do.
Okay, go ahead.
I've been listening to your objections to American foreign policy. And
hang on, she can't hear you. I'm going to have to do something about that.
All right, I'll hold on.
Okay, now that's better.
Go ahead, start over.
Yes, Ann, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi. I've been listening to your objections to American foreign policy, and I certainly sympathize with that because I have my own objections to American foreign policy. I would like to say, though, that it's not just American foreign policy, okay? Now, let's make sure that it's clear I'm saying it is partly American foreign policy, okay? Do you hear me?
Yes, I hear you. I'm
waiting
to hear the punchline.
But the other part of it, and this is the part that nobody ever wants to talk about, there is such a thing as overpopulation and overbreeding and personal responsibility to breed responsibly. And that is not something that can be overlooked. That is a critical component of the immigration problem as well as all the other problems that the world faces. Now, you make immigrants sound like they're just 100% poor victims that have no control over their own lives. And they're not. They're fully capable of breeding responsibly if they choose to. And the idea that we can't even talk about that merely perpetuates the problem. Because when they come to this country, you're right, they work hard. They work damn hard, at least for the first generation. But it's not too long before they expect to get to consume at an American lifestyle and have all the benefits of an American, including citizenship. So at that point, they're having a third world birth rate and a first world appetite, which is the worst possible combination. And yet nobody can say anything about that because we would be politically incorrect or racist or insensitive or xenophobic or you name it to point this out. But that is the facts of the case. And I can tell you from personal experience.
Okay, can we get, before you continue, can we give a chance to Ann to respond? Because you could go on and on and on, but at some point.
Well, geez, I've talked for a couple minutes. She's talked for an hour.
Do you want a response? She's my guest. You're calling in asking a question. I want to give her a chance to respond. I'm not saying that I'm going to hang up on you. I'm saying, you've made a point. Now, can she respond to it? And then you can make some more points.
But thank you.
I want to give her a chance before, you know, we've gone on to something else. So, Ann?
Yes. Well, I think that I'm very concerned about the same issues, actually, with a world population of 6.5 billion and the fact that we're not going to have everybody living the American lifestyles. It would require three planet Earths to do so. I also, as an environmental scientist, am very concerned about this issue. However, when we're dealing with the issue of Mexican immigrants from Mexico, in Mexico and these farming cultures, because the corn, bean, and squash intercrop is so labor-intensive, there are large families. I found families as big as 15 people even. So there are large families. That's a fact. However, when people come here and immigrate, the birth rate drops precipitously. Most of the people coming from 15 or 10 families in Mexico have 2 to 3 at the most here, and each generation becomes less as the children become educated. So there's a tremendous drop in births. I don't have any families in my study with 15 kids or even an interest in that. I mean, most of the immigrants I've talked to, 3 is considered a lot. And then regarding the other factor we have to look at is use of resources. I would wager that you, as an American citizen, probably use more resources than all 15 members of a subsistence family. I know I do. And we have cars, we have stereos, we've got fancy clothes, we've got state-of-the-art cooking facilities. We've got most of these subsistence farm family members live with very minimal things. They've got adobe houses. They've got dirt floors. They may have a small stove that they've saved for. And most of the ones that I've talked to are not so much interested in the American dream. I have never heard the word American dream used by a single interviewee in my study. What they're here for is to work and survive. And to do that, oftentimes just to be able to live in the cost of housing market that we have here, many of them have to double up with another family in a small apartment or have three or four families living in a small place. They're hardly living the American dream. Now, one of the things that I did find universally among the farm worker families that I interviewed is that they all 100% want their children educated so they don't have to be involved in farm work. But even then, once they become educated, and some of them have, they're not into ostentatiousness. I have not seen that. So I think that is a myth that's being perpetuated somewhere about this overpopulation caused by immigrants. I just simply, quite frankly, don't see it.
Pat, I'm going to let you make a few more points, and then I'm going to have to open the line up for some other folks. So go ahead and respond.
Yes. She initially, this could take an hour to respond to what she just said, but I realize I have a minute if I'm lucky. She said this family has 15 kids in Mexico. I would imagine that the more kids they have, the more desperate they are, and the greater the reason that they should be allowed to come to the United States. So if the implications are that we need to let that family with their 15 kids come here. Secondly, the birth rate of Mexicans goes up in the first generation after they get here. It goes down after that, but surprisingly enough, it actually goes up slightly once it gets here. And that's partly because of the illusion of this country being the land of milk and honey, where there's plenty of resources, and consequently you can have more kids. I know that goes contrary to conventional thinking, but that is true. Also, the idea that I consume more than 15 or 17 Mexicans, I strongly beg to differ. I live in a tiny converted garage, and I, as you suggested, do not have fancy clothes. Anybody that knows me would laugh at the idea that I have fancy clothes and that I live at a normal American lifestyle. I'm a very conscientious consumer, and I can go down the line about that, but I'll spare you. I would like to say, if I still have one point I can make, I prioritize. My top priority is redwood preservation, and that's why I live here. That's what I live for. Primarily, that's my absolute top priority. You know what? The Mexican gangs in the forests now have these pot farms. They've got guns. They've got booby traps. They're agricultural practices are atrocious. They log, they fill streams with pesticides, they over-fertilize.
And the Mexicans are the only ones doing this, huh?
What?
And the Mexicans are the only ones doing this,
Well, it's
this,
primarily
huh?
the Mexican mafia. And the park rangers are now telling hikers and people like me who do habitat restoration in the forest, we're being told to stay away from vast portions of the forest now because it's too dangerous to be there because of the Mexican mafia. These are illegal immigrants, I'll have you know. And don't try and tell me that illegal crime is just this tiny, 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 insignificant little fraction of an otherwise wonderful, hardworking community. Yes, Mexicans are hard workers. That's why people hire them when they sneak in here, and that's why the government tolerates them. But they also contribute greatly to our crime rate, and their high birth rates, frankly, need to be confronted, just like American overconsumption needs to be confronted, because overbreeding ultimately is overconsuming.
Okay. I think that you've made several points that I think were made very clearly, and at this point, I would
George.
Yeah, but before you hang up, actually, maybe Anne was asking at one point when you were going on about the... Well, excuse me? No, she was asking where you got your facts and figures on a couple of things. So, Anne, could you respond?
Well, yes. The data on the increase in births in Mexicans when they get here, I have seen exactly the opposite.
Where is your data?
My data is from Watsonville and Salinas and the families that I interviewed. I work with 33 families and know many. I mean,
so is that your data then?
I have it written up if you'd like to read
it. I mean, do you have census data or just some anecdotal stories?
No, I have actual data where I've recorded the number of children per family in 33 families and compared it with the number of children in the families that they originate from. And all I have seen is a decline. So I don't know where you must be working with a different population that I'm not familiar with. I don't know where that comes from.
I'm pretty sure, frankly, I'm pretty sure I'm getting it from the U.S. Census, but I can get back to you on that. And 33 families you've worked with, that isn't really a very broad sample base.
Well, I'll take your word for it,
you know, that applies to the 33 families. But again, that's not really a very big sample base, and I think the U.S. Census would be a far more reliable source.
Okay, well, maybe people can check out the U.S. Census and see what they have to say. And
Is there something else, Anne, that you dispute that I said?
Well, I think that juxtaposing mafia agricultural farmers or whatever you're saying that are in the redwoods and so on with farm workers who are, and other workers who've been driven off their land or out of their jobs from Mexico to the U.S., I think that those are two entirely different populations, and I would wager that the mafia farmers are probably the greatest exception. They're a minority and the greatest exception.
Well, it sure has a big impact on the forests where I try to do my work, I'll tell you, and the forests that I do my very best to try to protect.
Well, I support you in
that.
I totally support you in that. I live in a redwood forest myself.
I don't live in a redwood forest because I live in town, so I don't impact the redwood forest, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, I think at this point I'm going to open the phone lines up and thank you for your phone call, Pat.
All right, George.
All right. Bye-bye. The number here is 831-427-3772, and Anne, while we're seeing if anybody else would like to call in and make a comment, 831-427-3772. Is there something more you'd like to say?
Well, I think that those of us who are concerned about, again, human rights violations in this population, I think that there are some actions that each of us individually can take. And perhaps I could go through a couple of those. Or?
We do have a phone
call.
I was thinking that there might be something more you wanted to respond to from the previous caller, but maybe not at the moment. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Actually, I would like to make a comment, and this also is kind of in response to the last caller, but prior to him calling, what I wanted to point out is it seems that with these Minutemen and the immigration legislation that's being made a big issue of, that many proposals with regards to the immigrant issue were proposed but weren't allowed onto the Congress floor or onto the Senate floor. Granted, there are a lot of Latin Americans that are coming to this country. Nothing is being made of the people from other countries, European or Asian or from Canada, that come across the border illegally every year. And it seems that the rhetoric that I hear mostly from Americans is from an American perspective of how they think that these people who are coming across the border or coming into this country ought to live in their own country, which again points up the fact that the foreign policy and the attitude of the United States government towards other countries is one of, shall we say, simplify it and say, we can tell you what to do, but you can't tell us what to do. We can flood your markets with cheap products that are subsidized by our government, but you can't do the same. And then when these people come to this country, and granted there are a percentage of them that are, shall we say, criminals, but for the most part, I would say that those that are coming to this country are seeking a better life, and it seems that Americans use them as scapegoats, as you mentioned, or as was mentioned earlier, instead of taking responsibility for their own actions. And it seems that that is the case. I mean, not just here in America. I'm sure it happens in other countries as well. When the economic situation goes bad, or when something gets highlighted in the news and is fluffed up, shall I say, it just gives Americans another excuse for abdicating their responsibility for their part in the situation.
Do you want to get a response from Anne on
sure,
this?
Sure, sure.
Okay, Anne, did you...
Well, I think what you're saying is right on, and I think that, again, focusing attention on immigrants misses the point of NAFTA. No one is discussing NAFTA and its impact on the poor. And until that's done and we handle it at its source, everything else is going to be superficial and just window dressing. And it's really nice to have all the drama. I'm sure a lot of people enjoy having drama. But the point is, we have to look at the source of this problem. And the source, the primary source in the last 12 years, is the North American Free Trade Agreement and what it's done to the poor. And in fact, I have some information here that's shown that a multiple economic analysis of trade liberalization shows that the U.S. infrastructure creates a situation whereby moving Mexican laborers north to work in the U.S. is the only manner in which wages will begin to equalize as originally predicted by NAFTA. This is a reference by Marcuse and others on 1997. And so we are in, whether we like it or not, we're in a binational system of production and reproduction. And the two countries, or the state of California and Mexico, are now irreversibly linked. So Mexico is a giant nursery, essentially, for producing workers. And California is a place where capital is produced in this neoliberal economy. And until we address these issues, I don't think we're going to have much luck in solving the immigration problem. I think driving people off their land, forcing them to come here really against their will as economic refugees, and then passing legislation, punitive legislation against them, has to be one of the cruelest things that could happen. I'm surprised that Americans tolerate it. Obviously, a lot of people don't because of the huge immigrant marches. But I think people need to become informed so they see what the source of the problem is. People don't leave their homes and come to a country where they can't speak the language, don't know the culture, have to leave their family behind, etc.
And deal with hostility.
Exactly.
Enormous hostility.
Yeah. Without
and risk their lives to get here. Seriously risking their lives.
Right.
Many people die trying to come here. They don't do it.
I actually have a question for you with regard to Americans here in the U.S., and that is how familiar are you or what data do you have, and if you could address this issue about NAFTA with respect to American farmers, because I know that that has been an issue amongst some American farmers, but I really don't find much information or hear much about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and
so,
then
and I'll take my answer off the air.
Great, thank you. Thanks so much. So the question was about effects on American farmers, and when you're answering that, if you could also talk about just free trade in general and how it's affected immigration all over the world,
mm-hmm.
not just here.
Okay, put it into a larger context. Good.
But
I
first
bet.
About the farmers here.
In terms of NAFTA affecting the farmers here, I think a good place to start is with subsidies. The WTO is now stuck right now. They're kind of deadlocked because the issue of subsidies is really a sore point. And our tax dollars subsidize corn farmers in this country to the tune of $10.1 billion. If they grew corn and tried to sell it, they would lose money. But with the subsidies, they actually make money. And so now that we have corn in almost everything, corn farmers are essentially in demand, and with these subsidies, they're enjoying a boom as a result of NAFTA. The people winning in the NAFTA game are the wealthy and the corporations. Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill are raking in huge profits by dumping corn into Mexico. And almost every product, if you go to a traditional grocery store and look at the ingredients, almost everything has corn in it. There's high fructose corn syrup. There's corn everything. And of that, 50% of the corn in those products is GMO, and we have no idea what it's doing to people.
What about I want to let people know that you can still call in here, 831-427-3772, if you have a question for Dr. Ann Lopez. We're talking about immigration and NAFTA, and also if you have a comment about anything that's been said, 427-3772. Anne, so what about the bigger picture of free trade around the world and how it affects immigration, not just here in North America and South America, but all over?
I think that's a really important question because I have just studied one small strand from Mexico. I mean, it's of critical importance to Californians in the U.S., but this is an issue that's going on all over the world. There are 200 million immigrants worldwide currently living outside of their countries of citizenship. That's a population larger than the size of the world's fifth most populous country. And the number of immigrants has more than doubled since the 1970s, and their numbers are increasing by 6 million immigrants every year and represent a growth rate more rapid than that of the entire world's population. So this number is, the number of immigrants. The U.S., for instance, has the largest immigrant population in the world. And This is not just a Mexico-U.S. issue. What this is a global issue in which neoliberal economic practices are being extended all over the planet, and they're displacing people to an unprecedented degree. And again, the individuals who thus far, it's been shown, are winning are the wealthy and the corporations. Everybody else is basically a loser under NAFTA and any of these trade agreements. The WTO controls these trade agreements and has a dispute settlement body that, one country can bring a suit against another at the WTO. So we're talking about a macroeconomic system that really involves the planet, the entire planet. And we have to ask ourselves, is this the kind of ethic that we want governing the economic practices of this planet, where the only standard is maximizing profits for shareholders at any cost? I have studied the cost to immigrants from Mexico, but there's costs everywhere, all over the world. And so we have to ask ourselves, is this all right with us? Is our profits more important? It boils down to our profits more important to than people. And this is something all of us have to learn about and I think do something about if we're not happy with the current situation.
Now, I just watched a documentary today that is called Wetback, the Undocumented Documentary. And it was really amazing documentary. I forget the name of the filmmaker, unfortunately. Do you? Yeah. Well, anyway, it was an excellent film. It's fairly new, and I'm hoping we can do a showing of it here in Santa Cruz. But in the documentary, the filmmaker talks to border police. He also talks with Minutemen, and he also follows immigrants on their journey, sometimes from Central America, Honduras, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and through Mexico. And I couldn't believe what these people go through to get here. I mean, I never really thought of Mexico either as being like a really dangerous place for immigrants from Central America to come through, but they show in the film how incredibly dangerous it is to go through Mexico, even before they make it to the United States and try to cross into the U.S., how all the obstacles they encounter. And some of them getting their limbs chopped off on trains where thousands of people are jumping on the trains. And just there's gangs that prey off of immigrants, migrants, and rob and rape and murder people. And it's really a harrowing journey to try to come to the U.S., especially from Central America, it seemed like, in this film. So anyway, I know you've seen the film as well, and maybe you want to talk a little bit about it, or maybe you just want to talk about some of the human rights abuses that occur along this circuit, this migrant circuit, and that occur towards the folks that you were talking about as economic refugees.
Right. Well, we have extended free trade, so-called free trade, into Central America, and so we now have CAFTA and NAFTA, and our goal, one of the goals of the current administration is to extend so-called free trade clear to the tip of South America in the free trade area of the Americas. And so every time free trade is enacted in a new part of the world, what you're going to do is displace farmers there. And that's what we're seeing. So we not only have Mexican immigrants coming in now, but we also have Central American immigrants coming in whose livelihoods have been destroyed. And as you say, they go through a harrowing experience, but they have few choices other than staying at home and starving with family members. Human rights issues involved in this are very sensitive. And when I talk to people in Mexico, several of them tell me that now people in Central America hire coyotes, these are illegal human smugglers, for a trip through Mexico. And then once they get to the U.S. border, they have to hire another coyote to get into the U.S. And so, like I said, you know, people don't come here lightly. This is a heavy-duty experience. Now, in terms of human rights abuses, if you have a copy of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, I'd like to refer you to Article 23, Number 1. Everyone has the right to work, to free choice of employment, to just and favorable conditions of work, and to protection against unemployment. Part 3 is everyone who works has the right to just and favorable remuneration, ensuring for himself and his family an existence worthy of human dignity, and supplemented if necessary by other means of social protection, which again was removed as a result of the sectoral adjustment loan to Mexico from the World Bank. So Article 23 is violated binationally by NAFTA and labor legislation in both Mexico and in California. And then if we go to Article 24, everyone has the right to rest and leisure, including reasonable limitation of working hours and periodic holidays with pay. And in California, the number of hours worked by farm workers is established by the grower and not by state or federally mandated legislation. And from June through August, during the height of the harvest season, some farm workers work 13-hour days, 6.5 days per week without overtime pay. And then if we go to Article 25, everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, and other lack of livelihood circumstances beyond his control. And motherhood and childhood are entitled to special care and assistance. All children, whether born in or out of wedlock, shall enjoy the same social protection. Well, the binational legislative and institutional framework, along with transnational corporations, preclude these basic human rights from being realized on either side of the border. These subsistence farm workers are often born hungry in Mexico from the hungry, impoverished bodies of their mothers. They grow up and live in a constant paradigm of hunger, illness, and scarcity. They experience the worst of the third world, and then when they come to California as economic refugees, their health actually deteriorates further as they experience the worst of the first world as farm laborers. Most farm laborers do not enjoy sufficient food. In fact, many of them I've talked to cannot afford to purchase the crops that they harvest. They don't have adequate housing, medical care, and their salaries are ridiculous, $10,000 to $15,000 a year. And certainly motherhood and childhood are afforded no special care and assistance on either side of the border. On the contrary, children are often painfully separated from their parents and left in Mexico, often for years, while their parents immigrate to the U.S. in hopes of working to provide them with an improved life. And whole families of women and children are abandoned in Mexico with no support when an immigrating husband or partner disappears from their lives. So these are just some of, I think, the most flagrant ones. And then you can refer also to Article 26, 28. I mean, there's just,
of the Universal
Declaration of Human Rights. Mm-hmm. Yes, 1948. All the nations of the world signed on to this. And we're not honoring it. Free trade makes it impossible to honor it.
I'm speaking with Dr. Ann Lopez. She is currently a visiting professor and postdoc researcher in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley. Dr. Lopez has worked with 33 farm worker families in the Salinas and Pajaro Valleys. She has also studied 22 of their family farms in the west central Mexico countryside and has received recognition and awards for her work. Her book entitled The Farm Worker's Journey summarizes the results, arguments, and conclusions of her research and is scheduled to be published by UC Press early next year. She is actively attempting to create awareness about the human rights abuses that are endemic to every juncture of the migrant circuit. She also has initiated many projects on both sides of the border designed to alleviate some of the inordinate suffering experienced daily by migrant farm workers and their family members in Mexico. And she is in the process of establishing a nonprofit organization on behalf of Central California farm workers and their family members living on subsistence farms in Mexico. She is also developing a website with information about the current status of the family members in her study and ways in which those that are interested can become involved with the work of improving their life circumstances. And maybe that would be a good place to conclude. Do you know what that website's going to be yet, or is there any way people can find it out once it's complete?
Well, I'm hoping to, once I get my book out, then we'll get the website running and the foundation established, and I'm hoping to be able to do book signings all over Santa Cruz, and I'll have that information available then.
Okay, and then maybe we can end on just again what your thoughts are on what the solution is to the current situation. You've talked about some of the problems, the human rights abuses, the sustainable farming practices that used to be the main way of farming in Mexico that have been basically cast off because of free trade agreements like NAFTA. Maybe you can conclude with your thoughts and ideas again on solutions and also where people can get more information.
Okay, well, I would say that, first of all, I think the first thing that has to happen is that we need to get NAFTA into the conversation. So anytime immigration and the so-called problems with immigration is brought up, we must discuss the North American Free Trade Agreement as a source of it. Once we do that, then we can talk about the impact on the poor in Mexico and how they've been displaced and are coming into this country, most often against their will, only to survive as economic refugees. And then we can look at making reparations for the inordinate pain and suffering and deaths that our policies and the policies that the current administration supports have caused to these people. And I think that a cost-effective way of addressing the problem on a national, international level would be to, again, divert a certain amount of the border budget, the border patrol budget, which is not working. I mean, we'll never be able to guard the border so well that it's going to keep people out of the country. To divert a portion of that, maybe $1 billion, and when you're talking about a $12 billion fence, $1 billion is a very small proportion, into establishing rural development programs in the countryside of Mexico in the three states from which most of these immigrants originate from. That would include Michoacán, Jalisco, and Oaxaca. And then on an individual level, I think if you haven't already done so, recognize within yourself that whatever bad feelings you may have regarding Mexican immigrants is really inappropriate and media generated. The post-NAFTA surge of Mexican immigrants to the U.S. as economic refugees is a response to U.S.-promoted trade policies that really have destroyed their livelihoods in Mexico and, in many cases, their family integrity. So compassion for their suffering and a desire to ameliorate the suffering are the only real responses that are appropriate. And I think that, again, bringing the issue of NAFTA's failure into every conversation regarding this immigration issue is really important. And then beyond that, I think each of us needs to contact your local U.S. congressional rep, particularly those who have voted for punitive felony status of undocumented immigrants proposed by Sensenbrenner's H.R. 4437, and demand that as their constituents that NAFTA be revised and that immigrants from Mexico no longer be scapegoated as a way of avoiding the U.S.'s responsibility for their forced immigration. And this contact can take place at a local office visit, or an email, a handwritten letter, a phone call, whatever. And then I think that all of us have to become informed. When I speak to classes and ask them to write me a paragraph on the WTO and NAFTA, most students can't do that. I think a lot of people are either misinformed or they know nothing about NAFTA, and it's affecting all of us, whether we know it or not. And then I think beyond that, we should do whatever we can in our own life to rectify this problem, because after all, I think the grassroots are the ones that are going to bring this problem into sharp focus with marches and demanding that their legislators address it and so on, and ultimately resolve it. But it is ironic to me that we have a president that every September 11th memorializes those who died in September 11th as people who were parts of families that are forever separated, and yet he supports trade policies that forces family separation. Many of the children trying to come across the border are desperately looking for their parents. And I'd like to conclude maybe with one comment from the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., and that is, our lives begin to end the day we become silent about the things that matter. And certainly this matters.
I just have one final question. Do you have any websites or books or anything that you would like to suggest people start with when they begin to explore these issues?
Yes, I would recommend Enrique's Journey. This reporter, the name escapes me at the moment, but it's a new book that traces the history of a reporter who actually followed some Central American children to the border and went through all of the different stages of obstacles that these children were confronted with on their way. Another would be The Children of NAFTA by Bacon. Another would be Mexico's Hope. So there are several books out there. Yeah, David Bacon, his book, The Children of NAFTA, is excellent. It talks more about the maquiladoras at the border and what's happened with the maquiladoras and how, you know, what happens to the workers. I've dealt primarily with the subsistence farmers, but this one addresses the workers in these maquiladoras. And then there's another one called Strawberry Fields that addresses the political and economic issues about the lives of farm workers in the Central Valley here. So there's many different places one can look. You can go on Global Exchange website and find information about free trade, so-called free trade. You can go on Corp Watch. That's another one. Joshua Carliner, his website, and find out information. So, and you can probably just type in free trade and get a whole lot of information, or just type in NAFTA. But again, I think it's really critical that we all learn about the WTO and NAFTA. You will never see it in the media, presented in the media, and you almost never hear it mentioned. But these so-called problems are the direct result of NAFTA, and people knew that this would happen as they drafted the accord. So, you know, we're just reaping what we sowed, essentially.
And in fact, the Global Exchange Summer 2006 newsletter, the top story is Fair Immigration Means Fair Trade, and they talk about NAFTA and how corporate globalization displaces workers, drives down wages, and makes it impossible for many people to earn a decent living in their own countries. And they say instead of dealing with the real causes of immigration, such as the links between U.S. policies and the desperate conditions that force millions to leave their home countries in search of work, Congress and the Bush administration are dead set on treating immigration as an isolated and independent phenomenon. They talk about some of the... Go ahead.
And then to add to that is during the NAFTA negotiations, it was assumed that lower corn prices would result in lower tortilla prices, yielding lower inflation and improved consumer diet. However, in actuality, related to what you just said, tortilla prices increased more than 483% between January of 1994 and 1999, with an average annual price increase of more than 35%. And at the same time, the Mexican government increased subsidies for manufacturers of industrial corn, coming from the U.S., of course. And the two largest companies enjoyed the largest influx of these subsidies. And then beyond that, the price, the actual expenditure on basic food materials in or food substances in Mexico declined 29%, which means people weren't eating as much. And services went down, services increased 247%. And some products, including milk, chicken, bread, and beans, are more expensive in Mexico than they are in the United States.
So you're saying that not only does corporate globalization displace workers, drive down wages, it also increases prices. Is that
which,
your point?
Which
so
the,
people
yeah.
have even harder time feeding themselves, and even more reason why they're displaced.
Right.
Okay, well, thanks so much. I've been speaking with Dr. Ann Lopez, and her book, A Farm Worker's Journey, is coming out very soon from UC Press, so look for that. And thanks so much for joining me, Ann. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Great. You're listening to 101.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. Thanks for listening.